It's 11:15. I would like to go ahead and get started, so I'll let everybody get settled back in. I see who's talking. So. Yeah, that's right, Sheila. Okay, I'd like to bring up Rebecca Woodard and Kim Bowdry from the Regional Planning Commission. Our next discussion session is on the hard cases, and there are other emerging challenges here locally that we need to deal with as well. Thanks. Go ahead, guys.
Okay. We wanted to start with just giving kind of an overview of the ISC program in Champaign County and to let you know that right now we have about 258 people that we're providing ISSA services for. There's about 362 people on the PUNS currently, on the PUNS database. And right now we have about between 15 and 20 new past cases, and that's pretty much average at any given time. We have about 15 or 20 new past cases, and about 30% of those are the hard to handle cases. So Kim's going to talk to you a little bit about some of our hard to handle cases.
Some of the cases that I will be just kind of touching on are cases that maybe we have already luckily found placement for, but the challenges are usually kind of steady across new past cases that come through. So Melissa kind of touched on it, the individuals with challenging behaviors, that is what we usually see as the most difficult cases to place. Recently I had an individual that had lived independently in her own apartment with community supports for at least 20 years. She had a significant seizure in May, and from the middle of June until yesterday, I had worked to find placement for her. In July, at the end of July, beginning of August, I found placement for her with a provider in Kankakee. There was an alleged rape by a staff at that agency. She was taken back to the family home. At the family home, she threatened suicide. And then she was swinging a knife at her family member. From there, she was taken to a local hospital. This was her third hospital placement since May, since she had that seizure. She was placed in the hospital on September 28th. Today is October 28th. She moved yesterday. She had to be placed in Centralia. I made calls statewide to find placement for this individual, and either places did not have any openings, or they heard that she was refusing her meds, she was an elopement risk, and that she had a psychiatric episode. Although she had been cleared by Carl Psychiatry, those three things were deal breakers. These are the kinds of things that we don't know what to do with. Who, you know, where do we turn? Provider agencies, you know, they cannot support these individuals. They don't have the openings. Locally, there aren't openings for these individuals. Over the past year, we have sent at least five individuals in crisis outside of this area because the openings just don't exist for them. We have probably 10 to 15 cases that are current ISSA clients that currently have services that I would say are challenging. The positive about that is that the state does have things in place that we can request as far as the SST team, or we can look for one-on-one supports for those individuals. The most challenging is the high behavior needs individuals or those with high medical needs. That's where we see the difficulty in placing individuals. We have some individuals that have been placed in residential schools through the school districts, and they age out, and their families expect that they will be able to find placement within Champaign County when they return. That is not reality either.
What questions do you guys have for us?
No, you can go ahead.
Plenty of questions. Do you know of agencies in the state that are being successful with these cases? I mean, granted, we can't necessarily place people anywhere, but are there particular regions or areas that have success stories along some of these hard cases, or is everybody struggling in the same way?
I think the struggle is statewide to find agencies, but I do feel there are some provider agencies that are more willing or more capable, I should say, of taking some of these challenging cases. The agency that just took the individual yesterday, they have a behavioral analyst on staff. Their main office is in Belleville, and so they have a lot of resources right at their fingertips. So for them, individuals with challenging behaviors aren't seen as such a challenge because they have the resources right there built in.
And what training opportunities are there for to get individuals ready to be, you know, a behavior analyst or to work on some of these situations? I think we've heard about some formal opportunities for that sort of thing. Do you know?
I am not sure what the training opportunities would be. I know that ABA therapy has become, you know, there's been an upsurge in that, but to become a behavioral analyst, I am not sure.
For clients who would qualify under this description that we were using, which I'm not really pretty happy about, but I understand what it comes from. Is there additional state funding for someone who has additional behavioral problems?
Yes, we can request additional one-on-one supports for those individuals through the state. Sometimes providers, that is enough to get them to, okay, consider these individuals, but again, the rates given to these individuals are still so low that sometimes the one-on-one supports are not enough to increase that rate to effectively serve the individual's needs. Dale pointed out it earlier, you have to keep the clients that you have safe, and you have to be able to serve them in the manner that they need. Sometimes even with the additional one-on-one support staff, it's not effective.
I was really interested. You mentioned the children or youth of school age that are placed out of state by education. And I was wondering, in Champaign County, do you have a fix on who those children are or how many there are? And to what extent planning is in the works so that, you know, that we're looking, you know, 2 years before they age out so that we can work up some sort of a plan? And then the other question is, what responsibility does education have vis-a-vis the, you know, the transitioning, you know, of kids out of those facilities that they have sent them to?
We are usually involved in the transition. Families and the school districts usually call us about 2 years before to let us know, you know, you've got this individual that we're looking, you know, to move back to your area upon their graduation from this facility. As far as a set number, I don't know that off the top of my head, how many families that is. And can you ask the second part of your question again? I'm sorry.
I don't remember.
I don't either.
Yeah, I guess what response, as a funder that sends the kids away, what is the level of their responsibility? You know, I guess the main thing here is that, you know, they have really taken charge, and it doesn't seem right that they would just essentially at the end of the time say, well, good luck, folks. And I think that this is also a population that obviously we're pretty interested in, you know, the kids that are aging out of education, to make sure there's a smooth transition. And
I actually can speak to that on. Is that on?
Yeah.
Okay. Oftentimes when the schools make placements, they're on an educational placement. And so when they age out of school, they no longer have a requirement to fund it. And oftentimes they don't. There are sometimes some mixed funding, but those are difficult cases. And then when they are now in the adult system, again, that transition age has a hard time moving into an adult system. So it is, you would think that there would be some planful transition back into a community, but they're kind of off the hook once they're aged out of the school system.
Yeah, I guess what I was talking to was what they used to refer to as discharge linkage and aftercare planning. And there used to, I thought that there was a responsibility that they had to make sure a plan was in place so that when the kid aged out and their funding stopped, that they wouldn't just be dropped off a cliff.
The educational system,
yeah,
or where they're placed?
The educational system.
And they do participate in that planning, and there has been situations where they have kept students, you know, past their 19th birthday or 22nd birthday, whatever it may be, until placement can be found. But as far as funding that placement, that is the responsibility of the division.
Why don't you go ahead and grab one of these on the sideline? And again, we'll go ahead and open it up. So public question is certainly welcome.
Should I wait?
Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Linda Tortorelli. I'm the coordinator of the autism program at U of I. And I work with families often who have children in residential placements, helping them get those placements and then try to be assistance to them as they look to as those children are aging out. I can tell you that, as you said, that generally 2 years before they're ready to age out, I know those contacts are being made. So there is a substantial amount of planning that's attempted by the school, the residential school that has the child, in addition to coordinating with the local school district and coordinating with those families. The challenge has been what we've often seen and you've heard in this forum, that when families are really insisting that their loved ones come back to this community, those options haven't traditionally been available to them. And so, and given the state of the state right now, there's not a lot of really good, viable other options. Sometimes then they end up then in our, that's how sometimes they end up in our SODCs even. Those front doors are starting to be closed. So I've just recently was working with a family, I know you have been as well, that was then placed down in Southern Illinois in a not a very ideal placement as well. So I have tried to do an informal survey of our special education directors, plus knowing the families that I know, to try and get to that question you asked about how many do we currently have in residential placements in the county that might be needing to come back. I don't know for sure, but my best guess is going to be, and maybe you can add to this, I'm thinking about a dozen, perhaps.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, about a dozen, I would say. That would be my best guess. I'm counting on my fingers are the ones I absolutely know of for sure, and then kind of extrapolating a couple of districts that I don't have close ties to, probably a dozen. So. And the funding, you already addressed. The Department of, the Illinois State Board of Education is the funding source until they age out, and then after that, it shifts.
Before you go, when they age out, mm-hmm. and then they come back to the county, and you think they're...
Well, they generally don't come back to the county. And Deborah, you know, please jump in here.
I understand that right now the facilities are not available.
Correct.
But should the facilities become available,
correct.
What we're really talking about, I hope, is that not 12 drop all at one time.
They don't, correct.
But 12 come staggered. But if there's 12 now and they're aging out, which must mean they should be somewhere in their late teens to early 20s, mm-hmm. I would assume.
Some of them are young still. Some are 8, 10, 11 years old that I know of.
So if we had 12 in the next 5 or 6 years, mm-hmm. we might have 20 in the next 15 years. We might have 30 in mm-hmm. the next 20 to 25 years. So if we're looking to do this, we're looking at significant amounts of money. And I'm not saying we can or we can't. I'm just saying we need to identify, do we have the money to do this? Do we have the money to assist? These are citizens of our county. They pay their taxes like everybody else. So the question for us becomes, again, how do we weigh the costs that this is going to bring about, and how do we make these decisions?
And I think part of what we were hearing as well is hopefully these individuals would get a higher rate in theory. You know, these are children that have already demonstrated a higher need than anybody else. The cost that the children are getting in residential ranges from about $150,000 a year to about $220,000 a year is what the state is currently funding them to be in an educational residential setting. So using that information, and again, people that have been through it can respond.
Well, do you know, Linda, is it still the case that most of those residential programs age out at 18?
You know, the one I know where your son and my son were is unique. Nobody else I have ever experienced has done that except for that one facility.
Really?
Everybody else is willing to keep them until 22, and then sometimes have been forced because they don't have a placement to stay longer. But I have not encountered any other residential facility except for the one that you're my
our
son
experience
read.
A little
our
bit different
is where our
than
kids,
the norm then, mm-hmm. because then you're faced with the option, the only option is he or she comes home because there's nowhere else to go, and the school district would then have to kind of pick up the reins again and try to put your son or daughter
and I know
into their young adult program,
that,
which is...
Well, and sometimes what they have done is offered them other residential placements to finish out the 22
okay.
if they can
that's
find
since,
that place.
That's since my days. It wasn't an option 9 years ago.
Right. Well, the climate has changed, and also the school districts know there's nowhere else for them to go, and they don't want them back. So if the school district still doesn't want a program for them, they will find another residential to finish out to 22 is my current experience.
Is your experience also that once the State Board of Education drops them from their funding, that the other state funds are not as sufficient for the individuals going into other residences?
I would say generally they're not getting that same rate, but you can talk to the rate issue better than me because you know more what's happening to them personally.
I would say if it's a rate of $150,000 to $200,000, the state rate is usually nowhere near that.
Okay. Thank you both.
Well, I want to put this back in context because I think Mike's point is well taken. At the same time, having the supports that can bring back, you know, a couple of people a year and get them into an appropriate placement is a whole lot easier to think about than the, you know, the long-term challenge of several dozen people. You know, so being able to kind of get that start and say, how do we bring back 2 residents a year kind of numbers, it sounds like ultimately could get us there.
2 to 3 a year?
Yes, I would say 2 to 3 a year is probably pretty average.
I think I was just going to speak to that. I think that there is one family that has been connected to several of us over the years that their situation, the child or student aged out of the residential placement, and there was no commitment from the state to fund. I mean, that should have been kind of a seamless transition from ISB to DHS, and that doesn't happen. And for that individual, I mean, you kind of end up playing the odds. And so they brought their loved one home, and then it was suddenly an emergency LIGIS. So, you know, to have to develop a crisis instead of there being a transition as part of the systems change that needs to happen.
Yeah, it used to be more seamless, and now, yeah, the state doesn't do anything unless they're in a crisis. Mm-hmm. So
that's an unfortunate, you know, the 2 years that you all start working with somebody means lots of people are working to secure something that, I mean, I know that one of the conversations that I had with DHS at the time when this was starting to happen was, oh no, they're not LIGIS. They're not LIGIS until they come home. It's like, if they were here and the school is paying for it, I mean, it's still part of our community. So it was just a really goofy dynamic that forces families into, you know, plus and potentially one more unnecessary transition for them to have to go home and get accustomed to that and then have to go somewhere else. You know, the hardship on the family seems a little bit obnoxious for a given need that's already been identified, and there's been lots of people advocating for it. So,
you know, you just mentioned a little bureaucratic thing that maybe we can figure out a way around. I mean, the students are being put into a remote placement, but they're still being serviced by the local school districts and should be on the rolls as enrolled in that district, so that you don't have that argument about, oh, they're not home. That's ridiculous. They're placed in a remote location. Surely we can find a way around that sort of thing. Is that an issue that it's out of sight, out of mind? And can we do something about that by saying, no, they're here, they're physically in this other location, but they're you know, in the case list and the other things that you guys work with?
I think for us, it's there, you know, we have them open in the PUNS database. The issue is the state, it's DHS. In their eyes, they're being funded because they're placed in a residential placement, so they're taken care of. The one fear is while these individuals are being placed at the residential school, if they are selected from a PUNS draw, if that ever happens again, then what? You know, they're selected, they're not ready for those services. Do we just leave them open for X amount of years when they are ready, or do, you know, that's our fear, is if they're selected while they're gone and they're not ready for the placement yet, or there's not a option available in Champaign County for their family, then what? But we do have individuals that are in residential placements on the PUNS database. Typically, the families that do contact us, once it becomes time for them to age out of their placement, we send them to DHS as an emergency case for funding.
I'm going to raise something that's more of a rhetorical question. You know, should this board basically be trying to set up some kind of training activity or something else that would provide a little bit of behavioral oriented services in Champaign County? Could that be leveraged enough to give us that baseline service that would be able to support, you know, two or three people coming back a year? And like I say, that's less a question than sort of an intro to trying to discuss that issue.
I think there's no doubt that we need behavioral support, more behavioral support services in Champaign. There are two companies right now that are working in Champaign, Skill Sprouts and Circles, that are behavioral analyst positions. So there would be, in theory, the ability to even contract with those agencies to provide behavioral support services, you know, to look into that option. We definitely need more, but those are the two agencies I refer families to when they have the insurance that can pay for BCBA services. I think, you know, when you look at other adult providers that take people with behavioral challenges, they have BCBAs on staff that provide those behavioral programs. And then probably I teach their staff how to do the day-to-day work. So the BCBA would come in and do the observation, create the behavior plan, and then also do the training for the people that interact on a day-to-day basis with people that have challenging behavior. And there's programs. Southern Illinois University has a BCBA program. U of I has a little tiny one that they've started. But there's other places that provide those programs. A lot of the classwork can be online, but then there's a lot of supervision involved as well. But SkillSprouts does do supervision for people that are working on a BCBA program. I don't know if that was your question.
I was going to, I guess, kind of along that line a little bit, the type of behavioral supports that the state offers, and I wanted to ask, was how what success you're seeing with SST, because we're finding that our experience is limited and it feels a little bit like a delay as or, a, you know, a gap to get to, one to one-on-one support funding, which we are finding very difficult to obtain. And we've got a number of people that we're kind of providing that support to, and it's not funded and it's not a long-term, you know, circumstance that we can endure, and it affects, you know, other people's service. So I'm finding that SST is a source of frustration. I was wondering what you guys are seeing from RPC and what your advocacy, or if you've got a secret to success with that, or.
I, as far as SST goes, I feel like it's kind of hit or miss. I think that's probably what you guys have seen as well. Some cases, individuals can be really successful with SSG. In other cases, it doesn't go so well. Sometimes it seems it's dependent upon who the person is sent from SST to work with those individuals. So,
other comments, other questions? And if we run out of things, Joyce, we want to revisit what you were talking about, direct advocacy.
Before you go away.
Sure, go ahead.
When we're talking about more than just housing, when we're talking about people with behavioral problems, is that correct? We're talking.
Yes, it can be behavioral challenges at the day program as well.
Okay, so if we as a group are going to try to do something for people who need help, we need to find out more information. We need someone to come back to us and help us understand what the cost possibilities are for us after we've exhausted insurance, after we've exhausted state funding, after we've exhausted all those things. For instance, we've got a house that has people in it now, right? But if that home was serving people with behavioral challenges, it would have to be a different kind of home. Maybe it would have to be differently staffed. It would have to be a lot of things. What would be the gap between what's necessary to provide, because it would be our responsibility if we own the home to do that, with what the state would pay? And we don't know what the state may pay in 5 years. Right now they're not so good. Maybe they'll be better later, but nonetheless, we're going to need a study of some sort to let us know what impact is that going to have. Because as a board, we have a set amount of money that comes in as taxes. And when we vary and take some of our money and do special things with it, it means we've had to take it away from clients that are already being served or that might be served. So I'm not saying it's a wrong thing. I'm saying it's that we have to know what we're doing with those funds and how it impacts all the other clients that we're serving.
Eyes wide open is critical, right? And I suspect, just thinking out loud, and maybe I'm wrong, asking one of these behavioral consulting people locally to come in and give us a presentation sounds like a great thing. I'm not sure whether they're willing to do that for free, but maybe that's an appropriate thing to pursue, because it would be interesting to hear kind of firsthand, you know, how does this work, and how do people get these services and what sort of training is involved, and how would we rationally expand access to these kinds of things. Linda, is that something we could look into, asking someone to come to one of our meetings and give a short presentation just describing those kinds of things? Number one, what they would do. Number two, you know, what are the funding issues? You know, how do they see expansion of services? What direction would that need to take?
Yeah, and then maybe if we could talk more about the best way to go, but I have two ideas. One might be to support the BCBA that does adult services. I think might be more relevant, as opposed to doing
right.
Along the lines of looking into behavior analyst, I agree that it's a good option to explore, but it still doesn't do anything to employ a behavior analyst for Champaign County residents or potential residents, but not have appropriate rate structures in place for these individuals to come here. Appropriately trained and paid staff to work with them. I agree with Dale that staffing drives everything. Nothing is accomplished without committed, well-trained, caring, direct support personnel to work with people. And until that problem's addressed, everything else is really secondary to it. And I understand that there are different agencies that are able or willing to pay higher rates versus lower, but as far as I'm concerned, even the highest paying agencies are underpaying these people for, they're just undervalued individuals for the work they do. And if we don't solve that problem, everything else is kind of a Band-Aid.
Dale, you want to add anything?
If I could just, I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's a little bit went from soup to nuts, though, from kids transitioning to behavior that, and you really have a big mix. And so I echo what you're saying, Deb. I believe you need to chaperone your resources to helping change the system of care, because you don't have the money to solve this with more group homes and more of that. You need to help find the gap so we can get the state to do that with appropriate rates and support. Whether that's maybe the biggest thing you could do is, if you got to a point, is maybe employ a behavior analyst that would be for all consult, might be the closest thing I'd see from that standpoint. The one positive thing I did want to point out, that we all want to keep our people at home in a home community, and that's very, very important. One of the important things, though, to enable that to happen, though, I see as a positive move, is the state has put out an RFP for two providers to do 2 4-person homes for people that, when they have their behavioral episodes, that they can go there temporarily with a real plan in to plan back out, so they can maintain their placement in their home community. And those two RFPs are not been finalized. They picked a couple, but it's not been negotiated. So I think that's positive as we go there to make sure that happens. And so I just wanted to point that out, that's one that we, it's a positive thing. The other thing I just wanted to point out is that makes this even more difficult, though, is when some of the individuals are very, very challenging. You know, we all talk about getting them in the community, keeping them in the community, but the other individuals they live with, that becomes a challenging part. You know, over and over we have is other family members. So anytime you put two people together in any relationship, we all have those challenges. What we constantly face, what Jennifer constantly faces, and Laura, but particularly in the residential, we constantly face is how that affects those other people's rights. And you know, their parents that have your people in group homes or in joint living environments, or at home, how it affects your own home. You know what I'm saying is true. And so that's the real challenge we have, is when they have those significant episodes, we talk about everybody getting community integrated and living normal lives, but when that person's going off, that it so negatively impacts the other person's life, that's the major challenge we have all the time, is how we treat each one as individuals, but how that individual dramatically impacts, most of the time negatively so, that other person's life when we deal with those issues. So that's the other thing we have as a major challenge, is not just dealing with that specific individual, but how it's affecting the other individuals they're living with, if we're doing any site that's greater than one. And if we don't do it greater than one, then we're not doing integration anyway, and that's the other challenge. We have one person that is one person still right now, and that person's life is a million times better than it was. And we had two or three staff that got pretty injured in that process. But at this point, I'd say unless something happened this week, I don't know. It's going a lot better. It's going a lot better. But again, the integration of that person's life. He's not with those other people. We put him in our apartment building, so he's getting some integration with other people. But there is those major challenges. And I just wanted to share with you that even as we look at those individuals, when they're living with more than one, it really has a negative impact on what we do. Thank you.
Is it okay if I just raise a couple issues? One of the things that I see when we talk about bringing in additional resources, particularly SST, I completely agree with the assessment that was said earlier about the fact that they seem to vary consistently. And speaking from someone who's seen a statewide perspective, it also varies on region as well. So SST teams are not the same based on where you live in the state. So there are some better ones than others. And the other issue is just if an assessment is done, I think one of the issues that we see is just the consistency of implementation of the recommendations, particularly behaviorally. And I'm not trying to disparage anyone's efforts. I understand that this is very difficult. But particularly from the individual's perspective, any variation in, who is providing those behavioral supports or at what time of day or where can really affect how effective they are. And so I just want to point that out that, even when we bring those resources to bear, a lot of times it's a consistency that causes them to not be so successful, in my opinion and in my experience. The other thing I wanted to raise was something that you had said earlier about about medically challenging individuals. And this is something when we talk about transitioning people from state-operated developmental centers to the community. This is one of the most challenging issues that we have not addressed as a system, even in addition to the behavioral challenges, is how we can transition people who require a high degree of medical support. And what is interesting is that we have had some limited success in the state in supporting these individuals in the community. And this is seen often before they turn 22, right? So the medically complex individuals who are receiving waiver services under that children's waiver do remarkably well staying in the community. We have toyed with the idea for years of creating what's known as a medically complex CILA, which I agree, I don't really like that term, but the idea is that you would staff it with individuals who were more medically trained to provide support to individuals who may need a higher level of care during the day. And I just wanted to raise that with you as an issue that I see, and you mentioned briefly about the issue of how we support individuals who may have higher medical needs and we can support them in the community.
Any other discussion, questions, anyone? We're getting close to our target here. Well, I'd really like to thank all of our presenters. It's been, at least from my perspective, it's been very valuable. And I think, our marching orders are wide and deep. Certainly, we've heard a lot of good input across a good range of the things that we need to consider. And as Mike says, we're always working from a limited basket of resources, and we have to direct it as effectively as we can, with the hope that we're not making, terrible trade-offs in various directions. So thank you to everyone for participating. We really appreciate it. And you can anticipate seeing some of the impact of the discussion here in future board work. So thanks. I think that's it. So we're to the extent that we have a meeting, we're adjourned.